Celebrate 50 Years with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hi, I'm Sabine.
And I'm Adam. Welcome to the second part of our 50th episode special. To celebrate 50 episodes of Robots, we're doing a review of some of the greatest advances in robotics during the last 50 years, and predictions on what we can hope to see in the next 50 years. In last week's episode, we covered embodied AI, robot toys, androids, underwater robots, education and robots, and brain-machine interfaces.
In today's episode, we will be speaking with Jean-Christophe Dufray on flying robots, Dan Carroll on the robot market, Christine R. Thurisson on AI, Andrea Thomas on human-robot interactions, Terry Fong on space robotics, and Richard Jones on nanorobots. Also, if you haven't had a chance to check out our new website, make sure you do that at www.robotspodcast.com.
But first, as usual, let's hear the latest news in robotics from Christine.
Thanks, Adam. Masaki Kumagai, director of the Robot Development Engineering Lab at Japan's Tohoku Gakuin University, has developed a robot balancing on a ball. The robot, called Balip, which is short for Ball Inverted Pendulum, is about a half meter high and weighs 7.5 kilograms. It balances on a 3.6 kilogram rubber-coated bowling ball using three omnidirectional wheels. The peculiar setup, combined with the inherent instability of the inverted pendulum setup, gives the robot great maneuverability, allowing it to balance on the spot even when pushed, to immediately move in all directions without having to first turn a wheelbase and to pirouette on the spot. In a demonstration, Kumagai showed three Balips cooperating to carry a large wooden frame. In future work, he plans on extending the capabilities of the robots to allow them to easily cooperate with humans for carrying and transporting heavy objects. Researchers at McGill University in Quebec in Canada have built a rapid prototyping system to create ice sculptures. They are now investigating casting technologies to produce high-quality metal copies from ice originals. In the future, they envision that a similar approach could be used to create models of buildings, and eventually for constructing the buildings themselves. Among many other things presented at this year's ICRA conference, researchers at Stanford University have reported on a perching system that allows their UAV to land on and take off from a wall. A paper and video shown at this year's ICRA conference show how a model airplane performs an aggressive pitch-up maneuver to reduce its speed and present its feet for landing on a wall. The attachment mechanism consists of a carbon fiber and foam suspension system to absorb the shock of impact, and a compliant spine release system that allows to detach the five spines per foot. The current perching system opens the door for significantly extending the UAV's power autonomy by performing long-term surveillance tasks without the need to stay airborne and by potentially allowing a UAV to recharge its batteries using solar cells. The researchers are now working on combining their perching system with an ability to crawl and maneuver to reorient the plane on the wall after landing. For a video of Kumagai's balancing Balip robot, McGill's rapid ice sculpture prototyping system, and Stanford's perching UAV, as well as more coverage from the ICRA 2010 conference, visit the Robots Forum at www.robotspodcast.com/forum.
Thanks, Christine. Our first guest is Jean-Christophe Dufray from the EPFL for his expert view on flying robots.
Hi, Jean-Christophe. Welcome to Robots.
Hello.
Can you tell us, from your point of view, what were the biggest advances in flying robotics in the last 50 years?
So it all depends how you define flying robotics, of course. I would suggest we let aside all what is related to general aviation, like the airliners and everything. So we won't be speaking about autopilots. So if we define a flying robot as being, you know, a small thing that would mostly fly autonomously in the sky or indoor environments, the history is not doesn't go back to 50 years. So to me, it looks like everything started more or less in the early 90s with the advent of the availability of the GPS, high precision GPS or differential GPS. And in fact, it's interesting to see that it was only in 95 that competitors or the team from Stanford did perform a task that consisted in carrying an object, transporting from one place to the other successfully. And that was within the international competition, I can't remember, International Aerial Robotics Competition. So after only 4 years of competition, there has been one team that would succeed in this task, thanks to the DGPS, the differential GPS. So I think, flying robotics is not so old. And starting from then, so in the 90s more or less, then the old field really grew up quite quickly, and we saw a lot of projects out of this field. In particular, on the side of accurate and dynamic flight control, we have seen a lot of things there. So it's mainly about classical control theory, but with highly dynamical systems, of course, because flying robots are very dynamic most of the time. And there, quite recently, I think it was in the 2000 and around 2005, something like this, we saw a few theses, for example, from Zurich at ETHZ, Dr. Merkley, who demonstrated nice aerobatics control, for example, with fixed-winged aircraft. There has been also this work by Peter Abil at Stanford with the aerobatic helicopter. So this is demonstrated that now it's a more or less a solved problem. So if you have a good positioning, good state information about your robot, then you can really accurate control its flight path in the 6 degrees of freedom. So this is more or less solved. And now we see more and more small miniature autopilot that can drive your robot wherever you want. So we also seen in the last years and quite important research or efforts put in what we call bio-inspired robotics. And there it has been mainly about three different things. So first, the morphology, flapping wings, stuff like this, to try and see if we could re-implement that kind of lift principle in order to, for example, have flying robots that could hover, but at the same time fly fast forward and backward, maybe sometimes. Then at the sensor level also, can we re-implement the compound eye of insects, for example, in order to better sense the environment or to sense it not more accurately but faster, in order to react faster to events. But also at the level of the control strategies, the behavior, in order to, for example, avoid obstacles or fly at low altitude, which was not really the case of the previous projects that were more looking at flying high in the sky, far from objects. And indeed, flying in the vicinity of obstacles is something that is not completely solved at this stage. When I say flying in the vicinity of obstacles, I mean flying indoors or in urban canyons or really doing some high-speed terrain following among trees or mountains. And there have been a few projects, including the one at CMU by Sebastian Scherer, showing a helicopter with a 3D laser scanner to basically maintain a 3D map of the environment and then move around buildings, which was quite impressive. At EPFL, we also have been working on terrain following, tree avoidance, obstacle avoidance, or indoor wall avoidance. Even more recently, that was, I think, last year in 2009, MIT shown a really impressive achievement by doing SLAM, simultaneous localization and map building, indoors. So they were able to show that with a quadrotor, 2D laser rangefinder to actually build the map, the 3D map of the environment at a very, very small scale indeed, because I guess the robot was not more than 2 kilograms, and to efficiently navigate in this indoor environment. And now I think the last thing that we saw is the collective operation of systems, aerial systems. So there I can mention maybe the work by Jonathan Howe at MIT with the quadrotors indoor doing job sharing somehow to follow moving targets on the ground. Or the work at EPFL, also the swarming MAVs, for example, small fixed-wing aircraft that spread into the environment in order to relay communication from one base station, for example, to a user in the field. There's been also a lot of work at the University of Colorado, and other people are starting to really think of putting several like teams of maybe 10 or 20 robots into the air so that they can help each other to achieve a certain task or to cover a certain area to take pictures, for example.
Now, where do you see flying robotics going in the next 50 years?
So I think we will see a lot of achievements in the recent field that's just started somehow. So flight in cluttered environment, in the vicinity of objects, of buildings, will probably go on, and there we'll see a lot of achievements. So that means that the flying robots will be able to get closer to humans, to interact with objects, to maybe land on buildings, perch for some time, and then fly again, stuff like this. So there are many things to solve still, and I think we'll see a lot of development that will help to really have useful flying robots, not the ones that are just flying or be useful for military people to take images at high altitude, but really flying robots that come closer to us in some cases, or also in the indoor flying area. There we'll see a lot of improvement, really having a robot that can easily go over all objects that are lying on the ground or the furniture or any obstacles that you can have in indoor environment and being able to navigate efficiently while maybe mapping the environment. Then I guess, yeah, this interaction with objects is quite important. So that could be to inspect. So being close to objects means that you can better inspect them. You can inspect bridges. You can also go and carry stuff, small stuff. Why not? You could have a flying robot that brings you your passport when you forgot it and you are at the airport. You can also exploit the fact that you are close or in contact with objects by, as I said, resting for a while or just be on a good position to observe and to provide surveillance. But this being close to objects means also that you could be also closer to humans while being able to interact with them without hurting them. So this opens new doors in my opinion. We could imagine having in the future a sort of personal flying robot that would be your, you know, PDA that is able to follow you while taking pictures, and why not provide a sort of video interface to talk to your friends, and that could also fly at high altitude for a while to provide directions or an overview of the situation to maybe if you are lost in a city, for example, to then map your position or match your position with respect to a map or whatever. Or let's say if you are in a situation where you have no connection with the GSM network, you could also use your flying robot to maybe relay the communication. So your personal flying robot, that could be something that will come in the next 50 years, I think. Collective systems, for sure, will emerge more and more, will bring more opportunities to solve applications. And I think that at some point we'll see a sort of a merge between the flying robotics community and the general aviation, in the sense that flying all the solutions that are developed for flying robots could at some time be used for a transportation system for persons. So that then you could imagine going to your working place from your home by just taking a sort of 3D elevator that would bring you at your place or at the shopping mall or whatever. And this could be done only if you are able to, for example, solve all the issues related to flying close to objects, close to building, be able to identify landing spots, and be able to have a nice interface with the flying machine and then ensure a high degree of security. And maybe in 50 years we will see that. So being able to take a 3D elevator and then go to your work without having to worry about traffic jams in the cities.
Next, we go on to Dan Kara from Robotics Trends, who is an expert on the robotics market. He'll be telling us about where the buck is.
Hi, Dan. Welcome back to Robots.
Hi, Sabine. Good to speak to you again.
What have been the major developments in the robotics industry over the last 50 years?
Sure. Well, that's a great deal of time, but I think at the beginning you'd have to say the rise of industrial robotics in manufacturing, primarily for the automotive industries, but later on for the electronics industries and a variety of others. And they've proven themselves. They've made money. That's a $4 to $5 billion, even $6 billion marketplace right now, beginning in the 60s and continuing until now. So that's been a major influence on the robotics marketplace. I would also have to include the military robotics marketplace, going from nowhere on very, very rudimentary beginnings in the 80s and then really beginning to proliferate in the first Gulf War and then continuing on there since the turn of the century, both in unmanned ground vehicles such as iRobot's series of vehicles, as well as Foster Miller Kinetic series of vehicles, have been very, very effective for improvised explosive device work and a variety of other things, cave exploration. And then primarily unmanned aerial vehicles, which have proven themselves to be just massively worthwhile, low cost, and brings you greater capabilities in some cases. So they have been embraced by militaries across the world. So a major emphasis on the military driving robotics there. I would also have to include the advent of home care robots, such as iRobot's Roomba or the recently released Evolution Robotics Mint floor cleaning robot. These marketplace, the Roomba has sold over 5 million of their floor sweeping robots, and still that marketplace is very, very new and very young at this time, a nascent marketplace, but I expect it will be growing. We see the addition of lawn mowing robots as well, and they have taken off not so much in the United States, but in certain areas of Europe and certain countries in Europe, they've done very well. So again, the home care and advent of the home care robotics marketplace. There's been some interesting developments, and I think they're important, in warehouse automation and distribution centers, where robots now are doing many of the jobs formerly done by people, primarily transportation. So you see robots such as those coming from Kiva Systems or from Seagrid, where, in fact, the robots will deliver items from within a warehouse, either from a truck to the warehousing area or from the warehousing area to a truck to be delivered somewhere. And that's been a major breakthrough. These are, in many cases, autonomous mobile robots. There's been major breakthroughs in healthcare robots. What you hear most about is interventional system, that's surgical robots. Huge breakthrough. These are companies that are funded through venture capital arms, so, and they go out and they make money like regular companies. They're not part of, say, a military Legress or a government program. In fact, they'll go out and serve that marketplace. So companies such as Intuitive Surgical or Mako Surgical or Cardio Robotics focus on surgical area aspects of healthcare robotics. Also, there's been breakthrough technology in hospital automation where, for example, you can deliver towels or meds from a nursing station up to a particular floor. Automatically, robots will go up down hallways and go up an elevator, and they will deliver these things to two nursing stations from, say, somewhere like a pharmacy in the hospital. So something like Aethon's Tug Robots or CCS Robotics also makes a product. It's interesting to note that Aethon just partnered with Bosch, which is a major European company, to get distribution throughout the world. And then CCS Robotics has just partnered with Swisslog Healthcare for the same reason. So that's been a major effort in a growth area in robotics. I would also have to add the exploration robots, primarily the Mars rovers, although there's been other ones as well. These have caught the imagination of the world. They've performed way past their duty time. I believe they're only supposed to be on for a matter of months, and they've run up 5 years and more at this particular time. So they're very exciting and have proven themselves. The educational robotics marketplace, I think this whole concept of supporting science, technology, engineering, and mathematics through the use of robots and using that as an enabling technology or an enabler to do that has caught on throughout the industrialized world. That will become, I believe, much like a computer science department or a computer science lab, say in K-12, part of a basic curriculum throughout the industrialized world. So all of Europe, most of Asia, India, certainly North America as well, and parts of South America, robotics will become much like computer science has, both at a in the high school level, even in the middle school level, certainly at the college level and at the PhD level and graduate school level, will become its own separate department. And that's already happening. I would think something I might want to add is the robot competitions. And this would be things such as the DARPA Grand Challenge, for example, or the DARPA Urban Challenge, where robots proven themselves that they could drive hundreds of miles and successfully, autonomously, or they can drive through traffic autonomously. And then let's not forget things such as the smaller competitions designed primarily for children, things like Robo Games or Botball or FIRST or RoboCup. These are often tied in with educational initiatives, but still, they even unto themselves, sometimes they run just for the fun of it. And it's been a huge enabler for the robotics marketplace. There's a myriad of other of these competitions throughout the world, and so most people are aware of them, one or the other, or have children that are involved with them. I would also add, say, the toy marketplace. It's an $80 billion marketplace, about $25 billion of that spent in the United States. The robotic smart toys, so things such as Furby or RoboSapiens, or even the Zuzu pets, which came out this year, are a type of robot. They have sensors, they react to their environment, and so in fact they are robots. And then I would also focus on just the research that's been going on, particularly since the 70s on, and the prototype robots that have caught the imagination of people, things like Osimo or HRP2 coming from Kawada Systems. All of these things have driven the robotics marketplace, I believe, for the first 50 years. And it's not one thing over another. Certainly without industrial robots, we wouldn't be where we are. And military has driven a lot of that in terms of money. But all of these areas I mentioned, healthcare, smart toys, competitions, educational robotics, the Mars Explorers, they've all driven this marketplace to get us to where we are now.
And what is your prediction for the next 50 years in the robotics industry?
Well, 50 years is a long time, but at least it's not totally open-ended. So I don't see us being replaced in 50 years by robots. But I would suspect that what you're going to find in overall is just adding more intelligence, more autonomy, more robustness, more capability, and more manipulation. So robots will moving into areas where they never thought they could before, in many cases working with or in close quarters to humans. So I suspect the industrial space, you're going to get bigger robots that handle just much, much more larger pieces of working material. And I also suspect they're going to be going smaller and starting to support things out of those vertical market segments that I mentioned earlier, outside of an automotive and outside of electronics manufacturing, to move into other vertical market segments such as food handling, and things such as that sort. Also, I suspect you're also going to move into small to medium enterprises, and there's a lot of emphasis on moving into there and into those marketplaces. Now, to build low-cost robots, again, robots that I believe that will interact with people to do more fine manipulation and fine handling of variety of materials. In terms of the military, you know, in addition to ground systems and aerial systems, you'll be getting some surface-based robots as well as subsurface-based robots under the water. Most of these will be adding a great deal of autonomy and a great deal of intelligence. And I wouldn't be surprised to have, in terms of unmanned aerial vehicles, systems that will fly for weeks, if not months. They might be lighter than air machines that will be autonomous. So, again, more autonomy and more and greater capabilities. In home care, I suspect you're going to add, and this is a marketplace that really hasn't taken off yet. I do think that the lawn care robots will take off eventually here and as well as in other countries. And then home care will be mostly limited, I believe, for the next, say, 20 years to single-function robots, perhaps some multi-function robots. I do suspect that you might get something that will be a robotic device that will access sort of a nexus of control and interoperability for a variety of electronic devices within the house. So that, in fact, someone can talk to communicate with one single device in a very human-like way, either through voice or through motion or gesture, and have that robot be able to feed off those, process that information, and make the correct decisions on what the person wants to do. In terms of warehousing, more autonomy, you're going to get more humans out of the loop. Healthcare, you'll certainly be adding more surgical capabilities. In many cases, the standard procedure for certain types of surgeries will be the robotic option, as opposed to be in the it'll be the rule rather than the exception, I think. Robotic telepresence in terms of monitoring that. There's been a lot of emphasis and effort and research going in to have healthcare robotics tied into elder care, to be able to keep people in their homes longer through robotics technology in a variety of ways. I also think in areas such as rehabilitation robotics, those will expand. Educational robotics, as I mentioned earlier, I believe will become a core curriculum item for all classes of education in the westernized world and probably most of the world within 50 years. I believe there's going to be more robotics competitions. We've already seen that, like the DARPA Grand Challenge. You have the Google Lunar X Prize to go up to the moon and drive around and take some photographs. I could see things such as a 100-yard dash. People have been talking about having the Indianapolis 500 with robots in it. That's a race here in the U.S. which for cars. So I expect that to be going as well. Robotic exploration will continue and, in fact, expand. Certainly, I can't speak for the European marketplace or other places in the world, but the new vision just laid out for NASA places a great deal of emphasis on robotics. And in fact, companies who make robotic systems for the exploration marketplace feel very, very good at this particular time. So in all these areas will move forward. I do, as I said earlier, greater levels of intelligence, greater levels of autonomy, the ability to interact with humans and to do things that were only could be done by humans before will become much more commonplace. I also suspect there's going to be a lot of technologies coming about that will be robotics that you won't think in terms of robotics, things such as, for example, autonomous transportation. So for to get into your car and to have that bring you from one place to another, largely automatically, maybe not completely automatically, certainly as you get off-road or do other things, but to a large degree being handled automatically. And I can see that, in fact, being fairly commonplace within 50 years. That would also include flights, by the way, commercial flights for people to have the plane, in fact, take off and land, which they almost do now completely autonomously.
Our next guest, Kristin Arthurisen from Reykjavik University in Iceland, will be covering the field of AI.
Hi, Kristin. Welcome back to Robots.
Hi. Thanks, Adam.
Can you tell us what are, from your point of view, the major developments in artificial intelligence over the last 50 years?
Yeah, that's a big question, actually. There's a lot that has happened. And, you know, from the time when Minsky and Breitenberg and others started really thinking hard about the issue of building intelligent machines, a lot of thought has gone into it, and a lot of realizations about what parts of the challenge are difficult and which parts are not so difficult that perhaps people thought might be difficult early on. And there have been certainly a lot of disappointments, and you know, people tend to talk a lot about those. But by and large, I think if you look sort of in a neutral way at the progress in the field, you see that it progressed roughly at the same pace as any other field. You know, it's kind of been in parallel with the computer science and mathematics. So a lot of progress has been made in the last 50 years, actually, and a lot of technologies that came out of AI research has found its way into products, for example, dishwashers, cars, cell phones, telephone networks, cameras, and so on. And these are really important technologies that have made things possible that weren't possible before. And probably they wouldn't have happened without AI as a focus, as a research focus. But you know, on the horizon we have this big question looming: can we actually make systems that that match natural intelligence in some way? You know, just looking at the squirrel on the tree fills you with awe at how incredibly complex these machines are. Not just in physical capabilities, obviously, but more so in the diversity of environments and the complexity of their behavior that stems from the nervous system. And so, you know, you kind of always come back to this issue of, you know, are we on the right track? Are we reducing the complexity of the systems too much that we're trying to achieve? So we only achieve little bits of progress. And so, you know, I think right about millennium, people realized that, okay, now the future is here. Let's recap, see what we come up with. Did we figure out how to make intelligent machines? And by and large, even in spite of Deep Blue, that won Kasparov in 97, by and large, the answer is, well, we kind of made some progress, but we really wanted to achieve more. Now, that doesn't mean that the effort is doomed in any way. That would be a really premature and silly conclusion. And I think the most interesting part about AI to me, or one of the more interesting parts, is that it keeps criticizing itself. It's a highly self-critical field, and in spite of you know, big advances and amazing systems that people have built, we still keep asking ourselves these questions. You know, is this good enough? And the answer keeps being no, it's not. And I think the compared to any other field, as I said, you would see that the original hopes, of course, were absurdly out of sync with reality. Considering any other scientific field, the progress has been incredibly slow. And people talk about physics envy, looking at the state of advancement of physics, and they tend to forget that it's been over 2,000 years since people started thinking about physical systems. And one thing that keeps being forgotten is that with the scientific method, probably the problems that are the simplest ones get solved first. So the fact that AI came about in the 1950s, roughly speaking, is no coincidence in my mind. That's because it simply was way too complicated to address before, whereas physical systems, you know, chemistry and so on, are a lot simpler. So, you know, these are signs of an exponential increase of advance in science, and we should not expect the progress to be any faster with more complex phenomena that we're studying.
So given all that you've said, what is your prediction for artificial intelligence in the next 50 years?
Yeah, that's a challenging question, and it's hard for me to decide whether to try to do some prediction or whether to prescribe and tell people what they should be doing. Maybe I'll just do a mixture of both. So I think that AI should really try hard to look back on its on its original goals. That is the highfalutin goal of really understanding what intelligence is all about, using machines to understand natural intelligence and to model human intelligence, and also, of course, to understand intelligence in general as a phenomenon. Now, that with those kinds of goals, I think we will in the next 50 years see an amazing amount of progress, an amazing amount of new ideas and fresh ideas. On the prediction side, I don't think this will happen in a massive way. I think people will still continue to build their little circuits and solve their limited problems. They may not be trivial problems. I'm not trying to put that effort down. I'm just saying, compared to human level intelligence, let's say, which, you know, by the way, is the only example we have of something that we really believe is worthwhile trying to achieve. This is all these are all, anything else sort of pales in comparison. So I think people will continue to look at their smaller problems and solve limited industrial kinds of problems, improving the process here, making a better autofocus there, etc. We're seeing some very interesting new developments in, for example, in digital cameras with computer vision. The cameras know where the faces are, and you can tell the camera, you know, you should focus on faces if you find them, and so on. I think this will become increasingly important, not just in cameras, but these kinds of things will become increasingly obvious as we go into the next decade. In 2025, roughly, we will have machines that can compute the equivalent amount of a human brain and cost only 2,000 euros, roughly. And I think at that point, we will see a sharp, over a period of, say, 10, 15 years, we'll see a sharp increase and change in what people use machines for in AI. Each researcher will have more computing power available, new programming paradigms will be possible, and this will significantly influence and probably propel the majority of AI researchers into, again, looking seriously at the ultimate goal of human level and beyond intelligence. But I think it won't happen by any one person trying to convince people that that's a good idea, but rather that once the computing power is available, people will see, oh, wow, look, I mean, now we don't have to do this in a pipelined way anymore. We have, you know, massive parallelism on a single chip, et cetera, et cetera. And so so I think that will sort of that will really change the game. Now, some people have predicted that for some reason or other, we will see human-level intelligence and beyond automatically because the computing power is available. Well, that's obviously not true. However, if we look at the history, it's sort of shown that as soon as computing power becomes available, people make use of it in AI. And, you know, computer vision, for example, is always pushing the hardware and maybe is lagging a little behind on that. But nonetheless, I think these are necessary but maybe not sufficient preconditions. So I think, you know, once we move beyond 2025, once we're 2035, we'll see incredible change slowly but surely, and that then it'll speed up beyond 2035, and we'll see very, very different approaches, much more organic in feel, It'll be more like you see nature, and you think, you know, wow, how incredibly self-organizing and dynamic it is, and somehow it always finds a balance and so on. I think that's the kind of thing that we'll see more and more as computing power becomes basically free, and we'll stop doing so much hand coding. Everything will be more organic. It'll be more self-organizing and so on. So I think that'll be the next 50 years.
Andrea Thomas is professor at Georgia Tech, where she excels in human-robot interactions.
So, hi, Andrea. Welcome back on Robots.
Thanks for having me.
What have been the major developments in the last 50 years of human-robot interactions?
Well, that's a pretty easy question for human-robot interaction because, I mean, really over the last 50 years, it's really become a field. So I'd say the major development is that it actually is coming to be a real research area that people are working on.
And what do you see as a prediction for the next 50 years?
Oh, man, 50 years is really hard to say, but I think one of the things that's going to be really pushing the field forward is that we're starting to see a lot of companies that are really trying to get robots out into human environments. So, you know, iRobot has already been getting a lot of robots out into people's homes, and now they have declared a healthcare division that's going to be building even more kind of sociable robots that are going to be working closely with people. Companies like Willow Garage that are working on personal robots. So we're seeing a push towards a lot of companies that are actually trying to develop robots that are going to be out in people's environments and working with people. So that's really going to push the field of human-robot interaction further when we start to see real robots out with real people. Because to date, I would say that the field is still largely based on controlled laboratory experiments. So I think the next 50 years, we're going to start to see a lot more real robots out in the real world.
Our next guest now, Terry Fong, works at NASA Ames and will be telling us all about space robots. Hi, Terry. Welcome to Robots.
Hi, Sabine. I'm glad to be here.
What have been the major developments in space robotics over the last 50 years?
Well, you know, actually the earliest space robotics, at least in terms of ones that that have driven around planetary surfaces, were probably the Lunokhods back in the 1960s and 1970s that the Soviet Union sent to the moon. And those really, I think, were probably the earliest really well-known successful robots. In the years since then, obviously NASA has launched quite a number of robots into space. Perhaps the earliest one that was really well known was the Sojourner rover that was part of the Mars Pathfinder mission. And then that was so successful in being able to start roving about the surface of Mars that led to the Mars Exploration rovers, which probably are the most successful example of space robots. Those robots, Spirit and Opportunity, have been roaming around the surface of Mars for the past 6 years now, and they've really covered a lot of ground, made a ton of really interesting science measurements of various types. And I guess I would say that beyond Mars Exploration Rover, the most recent space robot is probably the Phoenix Lander mission, which went to the North Pole of Mars and had an arm on it that was digging down into the soil looking for water ice.
And what is your prediction for space robotics for the next 50 years?
Well, you know, I think these robots that I've just talked about, Sojourner and MIR and Phoenix, have showed us that we can use robots that get to planetary surfaces to do exploration. And it's interesting because those really have been our way of reaching out to places where we can't currently go with humans. But I think over the next 50 years or so, it's going to be the case that humans are going to be moving out into the solar system beyond Earth orbit, perhaps to get to a near-Earth object, an asteroid, perhaps to Phobos, one of the moons of Mars, or even to the surface of Mars itself. And then if that's the case, if humans really are going to be doing exploration, what we want to do is try to find ways of using space robots to really help human exploration. So this is going to be a bit different, I think, than the way we've used robots to do robotic exploration. Trying to think about the way that robots can work and help humans really means how do you use robots to work before, during, so in parallel, alongside crew, and then after crew. And this is a really fundamentally different thing because here we're talking a lot about human-robot interaction. You know, how do we have robots do work? How do we have humans do work? And how do we make sure that the work they do together really is very, very productive and well-coordinated and synchronized and all that?
Finally, we speak with Richard Jones from Sheffield University in the UK about nanorobotics.
Hi, Richard. Welcome back on the show.
Hello. Hi.
What have been the major developments in nanorobotics over the last 50 years?
Well, I think the biggest single development really has been the use of DNA, the discovery of how powerful DNA is as a constructional material for soft nanorobotics. And by that soft, I'm talking about the kinds of machines that use the same physical principles that are appropriate to the warm, wet nanoscale world, the sort of things that are used in conventional biology. So we're talking here about systems that are biomimetic, using things like principles like self-assembly and responsiveness. So it's been really significant that starting, I guess, from the work of Ned Seaman some time ago at New York University and developed by a number of other people, that DNA really has proved to be the ideal test bed for looking at these principles. So people realized, Ned Seaman particularly, started out by showing what a great material it is for doing self-assembly at the nanoscale, for making really quite complicated structures by designing the molecules that have the blueprint, if you like, for the structure that they form within the structure of the molecules themselves. And then, you know, other people have gone on to use DNA to make motors, to make actuators, that sort of thing. Work of people like Andrew Turberfield at Oxford. And then perhaps most excitingly, people have realized how to use DNA to make systems that do chemical logic, where you have logic gates that are actually individual molecules where they respond with a particular molecular output for a given molecular input. So really, I think these are showing these really beautiful proofs of principle for all the key components that we need to have that kind of functional nanorobotics that will be able to operate in the aqueous environment for example, in a human body.
And what is your prediction for nanorobotics for the next 50 years?
Well, I guess my prediction is that having got these components and having worked out some of the principles of how these things worked, people will put them together and they will make nanoscale devices that are able to sense their environment and respond appropriately. So I think the next 50 years will see considerable progress towards making essentially programmable autonomous agents that are able to operate at the nanoscale. And I think, you know, it's a process that will go from things that we have now that are very crude. You know, we have drug delivery devices that have some of that the character of an autonomous agent that's able to go to some, you know, it's able to operate according to some pre-planned program, and we'll just see more and more sophistication being built into these things until they are things that one would recognize as being something that is like a nanorobot.
That's it for today's episode of Robots and our special on 50 years of robotics. For more information on today's guests, come have a look at our website at www.robotspodcast.com.
Thanks for listening. Hope to see you in 2 weeks.
Celebrate 50 years with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.